With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, we have got a completely different take on the James Wiseman scenario at Memphis that you have not heard all week. You have heard from Wiseman's lawyers. You have heard from Memphis basketball. They're subtle statements, their official statements from the university, and you've had a brief statement from the NCAA. But aside from that, you haven't really heard from them, and in these cases, you typically do not. So the next guest on today's show, you may not know his name, but I'm here to tell you all about him. Tom Yeager, he was the longest tenured commissioner of any D1 conference when he retired from the Colonial back in 2016, 30 years as a commissioner. He also has a deep history in enforcement, and he worked for the NCAA enforcement offices as a commissioner. He actually served at one time as the chair of the NCAA's Committee on Infractions, which is the group that hears and assesses penalties for NCAA rules violations. So basically, he has been there. He has done that. He is a great, great guy for coming on with us today. Tom, thank you so much for coming out of your retired life to give a little perspective from someone who knows the NCAA side of all of this.
Well, thank you, Jess. Look forward to trying to shed some light on whatever questions you may have.
Absolutely. So let's just dive right in here. I think, first and foremost, some Memphis fans have this very distorted view that there are just a bunch of suits in Indianapolis who are, you know, sitting around, twiddling their thumbs, plotting how to bring down schools, particularly not named Kentucky. I think that's how Memphians might feel. So as someone who understands that that's not what's going on, and as someone who has been on the inside, who personally served on the Committee on Infractions, who is this group of people, and what do they do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, like you say, the staff that are out in Indianapolis are very qualified, energetic folks. I think you'd be surprised that they, a lot of them pretty young folks, and as well as some experienced people. All of them are tremendously qualified. You stack up their resumes. A number of them are attorneys. It's a first class group, and likely, and also they answer in the committee structure to professionals that are at the member institutions and the conference that have bring similar, very prominent credentials to any kind of discussion. So, you know, and there's always the ebb and flow. You're there trying to maintain order throughout college athletics, and there's no sacred cow list. There's no, hey, we're going to get these guys, we like these guys, we don't like these guys. None of that really exists.
Now, the whole reason that I originally thought of having you come on today, because as of yesterday, you know, there was still some level of confusion about what the NCAA knew when they made their initial ruling back in May versus what they know now that they've come back 6 months later, alerted Memphis that James is likely ineligible. Does it normally take new information or a whistleblower type situation to change something like that? Or is the NCAA just constantly checking in on eligibility on their own throughout the year?
Well, since we talked briefly yesterday, I had a little chance to look at some of the statements and going back, and particularly the one that the University of Memphis issued. There's a process early on that talks about the eligibility clearinghouse and the professionalism clearinghouse. And, you know, that's a form that is handled by the institution. The staff that looks at that are just looking at what's on that form, and a lot of it's not very in-depth. So I don't know if that's the, quote, clearing, you know, the said he was eligible. If all the boxes were checked, somebody would say yes. But then, you know, there's a more in-depth you know, analysis that can go on. There can be some more information that comes to light. You know, likely, you know, I've seen those forms. They're the Amateurism Clearinghouse, unless there's a red flag on that material, no one's going to see it. And it's similar to, you hear it a lot on the academic side. You know, test scores go in, transcripts go in. People are just looking at the boxes checked. And, yes, but sometimes there's a story behind that. So I know there's been some sense that this thing is kind of a reversal or changing your mind. I don't know what that original, hey, everything okay, really was and what information was there. But the NSA wouldn't, you know, if everything that's known now was known then, I don't think, you know, they wouldn't be reopening a new fire here. You know, so there's a little confusion, I think, in my own mind, Jess, about exactly what, you know, what this May 2019 clearance was.
And I think that's a little bit of the confusion throughout this, and Wiseman's attorneys have laid out their status of, you know, everything was known then, and within their lawsuit, maybe the idea of Penny Hardaway being a booster is the one thing. I read through the entire lawsuit finally myself yesterday. I guess moving as they move forward with this, now that James Wiseman is continuing to play and seeking this injunction, what is the process like for the NCAA as this case moves forward?
Well, obviously, it'll be working, as I presume the university will too, to resolve the litigation that's involved in the temporary restraining order. That's not uncommon. You know, haven't seen it much in the last 20 years or so, but it used to be a regular occurrence where there'd be injunctions thrown down all the time. And, you know, if that ultimately, and depending on how it is ultimately resolved, if it's resolved in the young man's favor, no harm, no foul. If it's not, then there's some question then about just what are the facts, and those need to be evaluated and handled and whatnot. It appears that from the university statement that they were saying we were going to withhold the young man, but for the temporary restraining order. So, you know, this is really between, you know, the young man and his attorneys, certain degree the university and the NCAA should be on the same side.
You mentioned, and we talked about this when we spoke yesterday, but everyone keeps saying how unprecedented this is. A player, and yes, the circumstances here are very, very unique and very different, but in terms of just the flat-out fact of a player standing up against the NCAA and utilizing an injunction to keep playing, you kind of brought to light for me that this was actually something really common in the 70s and 80s. You threw out Bruce Smith yesterday, who was the Outland Trophy winner and used an injunction to play in the Independence Bowl in 1984. I went back and saw Larry Gillard at Mississippi State played for 3 seasons using an injunction, and the Bulldogs ended up losing in Mississippi Supreme Court after the fact and had to forfeit all of the games that he played in. But from your standpoint, why do you think in modern collegiate athletics there was this change, or has been a change, of institutions shying away from this process that Memphis is diving into?
Well, I think there's a, you know, there's, I, you know, again, I'm not, and I don't know the real details. Like I said before, this is a young man that is filing suit. And, you know, the university is the one that determines whether or not they go, who they put on the court or the field or certify as eligible. And so, you know, there's been, I think, over time, you know, an understanding of what the rule is and whether it's clear and how it applies. And, you know, but there's constant lawsuits against applying eligibility rules. And, you know, arguably, if you look at the success rate of those lawsuits trying to establish eligibility, they have not been overwhelmingly successful for the students. And it just pushes, it kind of kicks the can down the road. And, oh, by the way, in between the 10 games that transpired, now have a, you know, have a consequence, and is a bigger consequence for the university.
There's that idea of forfeited games, but also there's more. So what exactly is the university risking by continuing to play James Wiseman if he is indeed eventually deemed ineligible?
Well, there's a, you know, that's a, I don't know if there's an easy way to answer that question. I mean, if at the end of the day it's deemed that he is not eligible, then you have the results of all those contests that came in. You also have, you know, there'll be an evaluation of how much the institution was involved. You know, is it one of those kind of standing in the background, letting things play out, or whether they were in fact, if they agree that an NCAA rule is involved, and you can have reasonable people disagree, you know, there's no penalty there. But you know, again, what their position and posture was, has been, and will be throughout the whole process. So those are all things that have to kind of play themselves out.
When you look at the facts of this case, where the booster in question, the booster who gave impermissible benefits, in question is one of the university's most famous alums who became a high school AAU coach who then becomes the university's head coach. I mean, just, we keep calling it a unique situation, but how unique is it? Have you ever seen anything close to this particular case? And how could this change how the NCAA treats something like this in the future?
Well, in one respect, it's not unique at all. You know, it's a little, I mean, and even otherwise, there have been high school coaches that have, you know, transitioned to being college coaches, oftentimes in the, you know, as an assistant role, bring along their star player. I mean, that's
right.
That's happened all the time. You know, in this case, it's the head coach. But, it, you know, this isn't really unique. And this would have been an issue, arguably, even if he hadn't enrolled at, you know, because he was a booster. You know, Coach Hardaway, before he became Memphis head coach, I mean, he's a representative of the university's athletic interests. You know, no question about that. And, you know, it gets more complex as he transitions to being at, you know, being hired as the head coach and the young man enrolled at that institution. But there were legitimate questions going back when, you know, just when the benefit was made to the young man's family.
The booster rule is key in this lawsuit, and there's been a lot of question about once you are a booster, you are a booster forever. In 2019, what is your interpretation of that? Is that something that could change down the line? Is that something that should change when you look at what constitutes a booster in 2019?
No, I don't think so. And plus, you know, this, you know, in the details of this, this one isn't even close. You know, this isn't even a close question. You know, there have been a lot of other cases where people have been classified as a booster on much different and much kind of more vague circumstances. But in Coach Hardaway's case, this is a textbook definition of a booster.
I think the thing that people have an issue with here, or one of the main things, is this idea that he became a booster. The time period between him becoming a booster and the impermissible benefit are separated by 9 years and a lot of circumstances in between that aren't always the case. Would there be any role for adjustment on how a booster, I guess, should a high school basketball, someone who goes on to become a high school basketball coach in a city who also happened to be a star athlete at the school they donated to, without question, be a booster?
Yeah. And look, there's thousands of those guys around the country. And you have guys that have attained their booster status in the 60s. This whole thing is fairly, fairly recent. I mean, look at all these guys. Some of the more prominent, Magic Johnson at Michigan State, and, even Matthew McConaughey at Texas. I mean, there's ton of them. And it's well known. It is well known throughout the athletic industry that those guys that are still in the coaching ranks in the high school or the AAU programs have to be careful. This isn't somebody that came from some European country and played there and was a student at the university, but never, that nobody knew about. That's all just static going around here now about, is Coach Hardaway a booster? Yeah, he sure absolutely is.
As Memphis goes down this road, and they're obviously wouldn't be going down this road if they didn't think there was some kind of a win for them within the situation. From your perspective, what's the best case scenario for Memphis moving forward?
Well, I think you just have to – I think everyone needs to have a good faith evaluation of the facts and just let things play out as they may. This isn't, you've thrown around like unique a number of times. It isn't that, I don't think it's that unique a situation.
Right.
If you distill down there's cases upon cases of similar things where benefits are bestowed on prospective student athletes in high school and some they're tied to university, and this isn't some unknown booster that no one at the university knew about. I think you just have to have, trust in the system and belief in the system, and everyone take a good faith explanation of where it goes, and let's see how it plays out.
We're talking with former Colonial Commissioner Tom Yeager, one-time chair of the NCAA Board on Infractions. Tom, before I let you go, and thank you so much for coming in here today and giving us a little bit more context from the NCAA side of things. And I do think it's important to strip away maybe the Memphis narrative of some of the uniqueness of this case and to boil it down and look at it as the facts laid straight out. Booster, impermissible benefit. This is what happened. You are now living that best retirement life outside of college athletics. And I think this is a tumultuous time for college sports with the public perception of the NCAA, with, 2 years ago, the FBI and college basketball. And just this last weekend, you have the number one player in college basketball and the number one player in college football, both dealing with eligibility issues. There's a lot of bad that circulates around college sports right now, but what do you see college athletics looking like maybe 5-10 years from now as we enter this next territory of college sports?
First off, I think there's been a consistent over the years issues with some very high profile guys having issues. You used to have, did they sign with agents before bowl games and Final Fours and stuff like that? So, that's there. But getting back to it, I think that the concern I have is that we're getting further away from the university's mission and the fact of, the students that are playing a sport that they love and where their athletic ability is helping them with their college degree. And, that all of a sudden it becomes very, we're getting there. Everybody's like in a rush to make money or do this. I said, well, go. The young man could go. You don't have to enroll at an NCAA school. If you want to use your basketball ability, go. you know, just go. But if you're going to be here, if you're going to be in the colleges working for your education, your degree, and I'm not, look at, you know, yeah, we got one and dones all over the place, but we also have hundreds of thousands that aren't. This is what the rules are. I think that, you know, you just need to, I think, if you believe in the in college athletics, that we need to stay close to the educational mission of our institutions and not just claim that it's, you know, something else. The pros, God bless them, go ahead, you know, and you're going to be ultimately successful, go right ahead. But this is what the landscape is here.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us today in Memphis. I so appreciate it.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.